This podcast is a presentation of University of California Television. Like what you hear? Consider making a donation at uctv.tv/donate so we can continue to bring you more great programs.
Our next speaker is Dr. Alyssa Marco. When my daughter was aging out of the school system, I thought it was time to do a new round of assessments, and I remembered Dr. Marco's wonderful research and his sensory movement issues at UCSF. And so I asked her to do an assessment, and we've come a long way in terms of understanding the neurology of autism. Dr. Marco recommended a neuromodulation therapy that's been truly life-altering for our family and had many ideas that were new to me. So I wanted to share her wisdom with you. Dr. Marco is a board-certified pediatric neurologist with additional fellowship training in cognition, behavior, and neurogenetics. She completed her undergraduate studies in psychology at the University of Pennsylvania and then attended medical school, residency, and fellowship at the University of California, San Francisco. She combines direct patient care with neuroscience research in collaboration with UCSF colleagues as co-director of the Cortica Innovation Network and as a clinician of the Lifetime Neurodevelopmental Care. Welcome, Dr. Marco.
Well, thank you so much for having me. It has been a total delight, actually, to work on this talk. It's a brand new talk based on what Clarissa asked me to put together. And I was also pretty excited to see some of my old Peds residents, Ben Mizell, in the audience, and my nurse, Jamie Romani. So shout out to you. Thanks for being here. And I am going to get started. Well, here we go. Here are my disclosures. I obviously have sort of some from the UCSF and some different foundations. And I also have been really enjoying over the last few years doing clinical trials, both for devices as well as pharmaceuticals. And I would have to say that I have feel like I've upped my clinical trials game in the last couple of years with the support of some folks who really know how to do good trials. The objectives for the talk today are first to go over current clinical genetic neuromodulation, neuroimaging tools for assessment. And the second is to talk about neuromodulation and pharmacogenetic approaches for treatment. So we're going to start way back in 2005. This is when we were all still at the Parnassus campus, and it was at pretty much the start of my clinical career. I had come out of my child neurology residency and my year at the bench, and Sam comes into my clinic Monday morning because that's when all the newbies get their clinical time. He's an 8-year-old kid. He has rising BMI. His head circumference is greater than 95th percentile. He's got spells in his medical history that were concerning for seizures. They were brief. They came and went. He was about 6 months old. They were never really found to be conclusively epilepsy, and then they went away. He had some late start to his expressive language and continues to have difficulty with some receptive and expressive language, as well as articulation, struggling with peer relationships. And now he's got, and this is probably what brought him in, a recurrent head turn and sort of like arm extension and a grimace. And so in my world, I had some basic concerns. What's causing the delays and the macrocephaly? Is he having seizures? Is this a tic? Is this dystonia? Why is his weight rising? He was active and, you know, engaged in lots of different activities, and per his mom's report, wasn't eating more than, you know, his siblings who weren't having the same challenges. And how was I going to get him support for his motor and his language, social and attention skills development? Mom had different concerns. She wanted to know why he wouldn't let her wash his hair, why she can't take him to his sister's softball games because he cries and covers his ears every time the crowd cheers. why he can't tie his shoes, why his teachers say he keeps going under the desk during class time, and why he's having trouble paying attention. I would categorize my concerns at the time as neurologic, whereas mom's, which were obviously the more important concerns, as sensorinomic, and it has taken me on a journey over this last 20 years to try and understand how Sam and other folks like him are processing information that's coming in from outside their body, inside their body, and how they're making sense of it. And I was told by Clarissa very specifically that we need less pretty pictures and more practice-based. And so we're not going to talk a lot about functional imaging. And we are going to focus really on emerging landscapes for neurodevelopmental evaluation and treatment, starting with genetics. In 1991, first known genetic cause of neurodevelopmental differences, Fragile X, came on the scene, along with testing that was able to identify Fragile X in individuals. Initially, generally, all of that genetic testing was done with blood work. Around 2005, around the time that Sam came into my office, we were moving into the world of what's called a chromosome microarray. Still pretty much from a blood draw. This looked for areas of duplication and deletion in the DNA, and we'll talk more about that. 2012, whole exome sequencing coming onto the scene, initially in the research labs, but by 2012, really something that we as clinicians could order for our patients. Blood initially, and then it was a saliva collection. You can imagine how well that went with my patients spitting into a cup, not very well, and then onto a buccal swab, which is where we're at right now for DNA collection primarily. That generally works pretty well most of the time. And then really in this last year, I have seen an uptick in the ability to get whole exome sequencing on my patients, even, you know, whether it's university-based or from commercial sequencing companies. And so I would say we are firmly now into the realm of whole genome sequencing being available for kids who need it in certain circumstances, and I'm happy to take questions on that. The other evolution that I've really been seeing play out is, I would say up until most recently, I have seen genetic testing be initiated by physicians, me or a geneticist or you know, other subspecialists. And more recently, I have seen families showing up with testing that they have initiated and ordered directly. I wanted to take sort of a brief detour. I know we've got a bit of a mixed audience into how the genetic scene works and then come back around to assessments. But remembering that the assessment of genetics is really got based on four little letters, A, T, G, and C, that get put together to make all of what we are. Three letters together code for an amino acid. And so in our RNA, we've got the three letters that code for amino acids that get linked on like the cars on a train. And depending on whether there are changes in that code, we will see alterations in the proteins and enzymes that make up and do the work for our body. I often will have families come into clinic, sometimes, you know, 5-year-olds, 10-year-olds, now 35-year-olds. And I say, well, you know, let's try and see if we can think about what the underlying contributors are genetically to the differences that we're seeing here. And even today, I'm surprised when I get the response of, you mean we can find a cause? And I said, well, it's not the only cause. There's, you know, obviously all the, if we find a difference in one gene, there's all the rest of your genes that are contributing to who you are, as well as your social and cultural and environmental background. And we've heard in the last couple of days so many amazing talks about the importance of those factors. But there are causes that we can test for neurodevelopmental differences and neurodiversity. And these are the big five categories that that I typically think about. And I'm not going to walk through these in detail, but suffice it to say that with the chromosome microarray and thinking about these categories, we were able to find one of the underlying contributing causes to SAM's differences. This is the results from the array, and this is chromosome 16. And you can see at the top, there's a where there's the green line, there's an area that dips down, and that represents an area of his chromosome 16, the short arm or the P arm, where there's a chunk of DNA that's missing. 16p11.2 is the region. And we know that that's a fairly common cause of neurodevelopmental differences and autism. We know now quite a bit about 16p11.2 deletion and duplication syndromes because there's been large consortiums funded to study the condition both here in the US and also in Europe. And there are also really exciting and fun family meetings that happen where the community gets together, and there's a lot of research that happens at those meetings too. We know that macrocephaly is common. We know that BMI greater than 95% happens over time, but happens in over 70% of the individuals. So that gives us really now a why for what's happening with SAM and helps us think about what to do. Vertebral anomalies, sensory over-responsivity, or the elevated response to stimuli that may not lead to an elevated response in other individuals, vacuum cleaners, blenders, automatic flushing toilets, or in this case, Sam's sister's softball game. We can also have hearing loss. So that would prompt us to make sure that we check Sam's hearing. Language and attention challenges, really common. An autism diagnosis in 25% of affected individuals. Motor coordination and motor speech, especially. As I was reviewing my slides, I was thinking about the amazing talk we had yesterday about a speech apraxia and the importance of getting to typing for communication. Epilepsy, 25%. Paroxysmal kinesiogenic dyskinesia, 9%. Now we know what's happening with the new movement disorder, and we don't have to go searching for more. Benign familial infantile seizures, that's what was going on at 6 months of age. Cardiac malformations, maybe a referral to cardiology. Cortical malformations, maybe an MRI. We have a lot of data on the structural and functional differences with that neuroimaging for individuals with 16p11.2 deletions and duplications. The next category of emerging assessments, blood, urine, stool studies, I see those in these different domains coming into clinic, looking for infections, metabolism, inflammation, autoimmune, and microbiome. And the big move here is, I think, something that we're seeing in the genetics also, is this kind of shift from physician-initiated to patient-initiated. Also, the shift that I'm seeing is away from targeted testing. For example, calprotectin, if you're, you know, from the GI perspective, to more panel-based testing. And I have to say, you know, from my perspective, I like panels. When we moved from, you know, single gene disorder testing genetics to whole exome sequencing, even a neurologist could make some diagnoses that I might not have been a good enough dysmorphologist to arrive at on my own. I call this testing for dummies. And in general, I think it's a good thing. There's different places that are doing panel-based testing, commercial labs, universities. The direct-to-consumer marketing is something that I think currently grappling with, and you guys might be too, where families are getting advertisements popping up in their social media feeds. And some of them are getting testing on their own. And I think that there's challenges for both the families and their treatment team when the data comes back, especially if, you know, as a physician, if you're not the one who ordered it, you may or may not have a familiarity with the test or with the lab that sent it and know sort of how to weight it. What I generally do is if it's a lab that I'm not that familiar with and there's a finding, I'll often repeat that more specific value or test in a lab that that I have some confidence in. I also thought it was interesting. I had a recent patient and they were asking about a test, and when I clicked on it, there was a holiday special. So this is a really changing landscape for assessment that I think we'll be practicing in. And I had just a couple of when I was reflecting on it, things that I use as sort of useful guidelines in practice. The first is to let the symptoms be your guide. And in my world, constipation, GI concerns, 60 to 90% of my patients. And so whereas 15 years ago, I was definitely not sending an order for a stool panel, now I often will, and I'm happy to talk more about that if people have questions. When in doubt, get a KUB. There is nothing that makes regulation more difficult than being constipated, except potentially not sleeping. And I have been surprised and gratified over the years with a clinical story that doesn't necessarily line up from what I'm getting in, and but the suspicion high enough, get the KUB, and sure enough, we have a belly full of poop, and the treatment of it can be really life altering. Low threshold. I personally have a pretty low threshold for referring to my GI colleagues, because when they pick up often an inflammatory GI condition in my kids with neurodevelopmental differences, and it gets treated, it changes everything. EOE is the one that I see most commonly as a new and sort of surprising diagnosis. And so I have a pretty low threshold for getting my GI colleagues involved. I also think for me, the skin can be a clue for novel therapeutics. One of the things that we often see in our neurodevelopmental clinic is report of eczema or atopic dermatitis, the itch that rashes. And more recently, I've been working with one of my community dermatology colleagues and with more of my kids getting treated for their atopic dermatitis, I've seen a really nice benefit for their general neurodevelopment. And so thinking about letting the symptoms be the guide and making sure to thank you, Clarissa, and ordering testing and getting help when you need it with the panels that are coming in that you have not seen before. Neurophysiology, really interesting and exciting things going on here. In general, 2005, all of our EEGs or electroencephalography looking for seizures, as well as our magnetoencephalography looking for foci for seizure surgery planning, was happening in the hospital, both for routine and overnight studies. In the last 5 to 10 years, both the university labs as well as some community commercial EEG facilities have done the ambulatory EEGs at home with the hookup at home, 24 to 72 hours of EEG recording at home and then going back to the house. That's been a really nice advance for many of my patients who just couldn't tolerate, or their families couldn't tolerate, staying in the hospital for prolonged EEGs. The thing that's coming is ambulatory MEG or magnetoencephalography. And so this has been, the MEG has been part of my research world for a while, and to see this translating into a wearable, like you can see in the picture, I think is really exciting. And I wanted to share that with you all. The next is neuroimaging across the past a couple of decades, moving from structural imaging to functional imaging. And I think what's emerging that's probably going to be the most exciting clinically is the ability to really be able to measure neurochemicals in the brain. When folks ask me about it now, patients ask me about it now, you know, can we measure the level of a dopamine or serotonin Oftentimes families are coming in having it measured in the stool or in the urine, or and I say, well, that's nice, but it doesn't really tell us what's in the brain, and that's what we really need to know. We are, I think, getting to the time where we are starting to be able to measure neurochemicals in the brain. We know that autistic children generally, not all of them, but a portion of them, will show lower NAA, N-acetylaspartate, in the brain in particular regions, as well as lower GABA in especially the limbic or more autonomic regions. And we know that those levels have been shown to correlate with autism symptomatology or severity. And this creates an opportunity for GABA, especially, I think, to become a measurable biomarker, similar to what Dr. London was talking about. And so I would say the literature to watch on this, I know that there's going to be a paper coming out from Nicholas Putz's group looking at GABA pre and post intervention. And I think that's really going to help us with guiding our pharmacologic therapies. And so I would say that is sort of here and on the horizon. The next is the digital developmental and cognitive assessments. This has been an exciting landscape. You know, going back to 1983, we had the continuous performance test. You've got a black screen, you know, tap the screen when you see the E, ignore when you see the A, and this is a measure of your sustained attention and your impulsivity. And that was pretty good, mostly used by psychologists, neuropsychologists, not as much, I would say, in our, you know, in the MD world, was really a helpful tool, I think, both in sometimes in schools and also in research. In the last decade, we have shifted from those sort of flat assessments to more cognitive or video game-like assessments, which are much more engaging and probably achieve a higher level of accuracy. And then, as Dr. London also mentioned, some eye-tracking diagnostic tools that will show a little bit more information about. And not surprising probably to this audience, the assessments are now verging into the virtual reality space. In terms of video game assessment, we actually took one to a 16P11.2 family meeting back in around 2012, 2013, and asked if kids like Sam have a measurable difference in their visual search ability, in their visual distractibility ability, and also how did they do compared to folks that didn't have a 16P11.2 deletion in terms of their ability to single task and multitask? And should those be skills that we focus on trying to help with? And the answer is yes. You can see some of the data here. The blue line is our folks with 16P11.2 copy number variations, and they certainly have more difficulty with both single tasking, but especially more and when they're asked to switch flexibly from one task to another and then back again, and also some more difficulty with visual search and distractibility. So that presented us with something to think about developing clinically for therapeutics. Eye tracking diagnostics. Again, there was a question, I think, about this during Dr. London's talk. And there is, I think, a beautiful body of work over the last quarter of a century on eye tracking in autistic kids, but also other genetic and neurodevelopmental conditions. I'm particularly struck by the work of Ami Kled and Warren Jones, and they've developed a tablet-based assessment tool that they're now working on using in kids down to even 18 months of age and younger to be able to see if it can work as a diagnostic tool to see if they're likely to meet criteria for autism. But more importantly for me, is there a measurable way to get a beat on their social attention? And can I follow that over time to see if our behavioral therapy strategies or occupational therapy strategies are actually working? And if they are, great, keep doing it, double down. And if not, let's try something else. So a digital assessment tool that you can do over time that will tell you not about a label, but about a skill, And the paper here by with lead author Warren Jones shows a correlation between one of the visual eye tracking assessments and the ADOS scores for a diagnosis of autism. Beautiful correlation, other aspects of the visual tracking with verbal ability and other aspects with the nonverbal ability. So I think we're really starting to get there. I think the more potent question here is whether it's going to be something that is going to be covered under people's insurances. Finally, virtual reality. I would say that there are certainly products on the market. They haven't gotten a lot of traction yet, but this is a space to watch. Wearable devices. My bet is probably at least 5 to 10% of the folks in this audience are wearing a wearable device as we speak. This is a really longstanding and interesting landscape. 1888, we could test for galvanic skin response. The 60s, accelerometers in 2010 started to see folks like Matt Goodwin doing assessments in autistic individuals to look at their autonomic responses to see if you saw a change in heart rate, for example, even before there was a change in behavior, and finding that he could actually measure that. And now there's rings and things and everything to measure sort of every aspect of our movement and temperature and physiology. Wearables are being used for lots of different measurements. They are helpful, I think, because they do give us real time and real life data as opposed to an MRI, which is at a single time point, or even EEG, which tends to be limited. It's an objective assessment. It can be in a remote monitoring. So instead of vitals being in a clinical setting, which we know can alter blood pressure, for example, heart rate, this is in the natural environment over time and can sometimes really help with considering an early diagnosis, like the work of Dr. Clinton Jones. And what I've seen it help with clinically already in the last few years is safety with location tracking. There are now also some products coming to market for remote seizure detection. And also I'd love to see it helping with being able to kind of get a better understanding of change in emotional state. So we've got patches and chest bands and headbands and watches. And a lot of my families are now using rings to measure their sleep, but there's also a lot of heart rate and physiology data that are coming in on the rings and watches. And I don't know about you, but they're printing it out, bringing it in, and I found it to be a huge asset when trying to answer the question of, like, how much are they really sleeping? And is there a difference in their arousal level at school versus at home that we can know about? Some of the concerns is that a lot of the devices on the market lack regulatory approval. Some lack accuracy. So you may think that you're getting an accurate, a reflection from a wearable glucose monitor that isn't actually giving you good data. And that can lead to a whole host of actions that wouldn't have been necessary. And also some have trouble with real-time connectivity. And you can imagine in some of our more rural areas that don't have connectivity, like we heard about yesterday, a device like this just wouldn't be translatable yet. So now we're going to think a little bit more about our treatment approaches. So digital therapeutics that require active involvement, neuromodulation approaches that are more of a passive therapeutic, and then neurochemistry guided by genetic diagnosis and pharmacogenetics. My caveat here is that these are just a few examples. There are so many therapeutics on the market that I would never be able to give an exhausted overview, but I wanted to focus on the few that I know best. So we're back to Sam. And we're back to his mom's concerns. And remember, the last one was that he had trouble paying attention. And so thinking about how to train his attention. And this is a story that began about 15 years ago. And as you saw, we had gone to the family meeting and assessed and found that there were some challenges in attention for folks like Sam. But we also knew in the work that I was doing that we were seeing this in our kids with sensory processing differences as well. And so I teamed up with Adam Ghazali and Joaquin Anguera, and that's Annie Aiken, who's gone to grad school and come back to the lab, and was able to benefit from their development of an iPad-based video game-like brain training tool. At that point in time, it was called NeuroRacer and designed by EJ Johnston, who is a great video game developer. And we said, hey, can we use this for kids? And Adam was great and said, let's do it. And so we did a study with EEG pre and post. We had 19 kids who didn't have sensory or attention challenges, 13 kids with sensory differences, but not attention challenges, and 14 with sensory and attention challenges. We put the EEG cap on their head. We measured a brain activity called the midline frontal theta. We did that before they did 4 weeks of training with the iPad game that became known as Evo for Evolution, and after. And what you can see top left with the healthy controls is at around that 150 to 250 mark, you want to see a robust midline frontal theta activity. That's that dark red. If you go all the way to the right, the kids before the brain training with sensory and attention, that similar area, pretty yellow, low midline frontal theta activity. Go to the bottom set of images, bottom left, again, our healthy controls about the same. The real change we saw was with our sensory kids who also had attention challenges, and now their activity in the midline frontal theta region at around that 150 to 250 range was really similar to our control sample from the beginning. And so we saw actual brain changes. And so that's nice. But one of the questions is, so what? Like, just because the brain's changing, does that mean that it's actually helping? And so we wanted to see whether the change was in attention that by Kara report. And the answer was it was at the conclusion of the 4 weeks training, 9 months later, and even 3 years after that. And so that was super exciting for us. We translated that to the next step, which was combining both brain training as well as a integrated body activity and a tool called PDBBT, pushed it into schools, looked again at brain activity, Courtney Galen helping to lead the study. We looked again at the midline frontal theta activity, and you can see that in the graph at the right. And we saw that after 4 weeks of training, we had an increased midline frontal theta, both at that early time point and then at a later time point in the brain activity. And what I think was really important to know is that the folks with the biggest neural gains also had the biggest attentional gains. I think this is the data that that Clarissa was the most excited about my sharing. This is our study looking at something called cranial electrotherapy stimulation. This is a device that delivers a square wave electrical current between 50 microamps and 500 microamps to the earlobes. The presumed mechanism is that the vagal nerve has receptors in the head, but especially in the earlobes, and that this electrical current is turning up the parasympathetic tone. I think that that may be part of it. We don't know for sure. There's so much more work that needs to be done with mechanism. We did a study with 227 all-comers to a neurodevelopment clinic. They did it for 4 weeks nightly, 20 minutes a night between 100 and 150 microamps. And what we saw is a really nice reduction in sensory over-responsivity, outburst meltdowns, shutdowns, better sleep, less anxiety, and tics. The folks that went from having sensory over-responsivity at the beginning to not was 30% of the sample. So that was pretty exciting. I would say the other big win with this intervention tends to be constipation. And I think it's probably all part of the same process. Finally, neurochemistry. I often will use a buccal swab-based tool for pharmacogenetics to think about if I can get a little bit more information on what's going to be helpful for choosing a medication. The panel that I usually get gives me a whole bunch of different a bunch of information on different genes, but the one that I find probably particularly useful is the information about an enzyme called catecholamethyltransferase, or COMT, and looking at the particular genetic profile for that individual in my clinic by doing a cheek swab and finding out whether at one point in that enzyme they have either a valine amino acid or a methionine will help me understand and better predict whether they will have a good response to medications like methylphenidate or the different sort of array of stimulants. We know that COMT breaks down catecholamines like dopamine, and that change from valine to methionine will tell you about whether they are a fast metabolizer of dopamine or a slow metabolizer. And we know that folks who carry the methionine at both points, for example, will have a 40% reduction in enzyme activity. So our kids who have valine from both of their parents tend to have a higher benefit from methylphenidate. Our folks with methionine at both from both parents show more adverse effects, and the ones who carry one of each tend to be in the middle. And I have found this, as well as the information about liver metabolism and dopamine receptor and the serotonin reuptake inhibitor receptors, to be really helpful in guiding my choice and path of medications. I always say it's not 100% right, because we're not that simple, but about 70 to 75% predictive, and I will take that as a clinician. So in summary, I think that there's a lot of exciting things on the horizon for both assessment and treatment. I think I'm seeing shifts from targeted treatment to panel-based assessments, and an increasing shift to patient-initiated, either they're ordering it directly or they're asking about it. The clinical whole genome sequencing from cheek swab is definitely arrived. At-home evaluation from seizures is feasible and evolving in terms of getting from EEG to even MEG. We've got neurochemical-based neuroimaging coming to clinical trials, and I think that once it gets through that pathway, will hopefully influence and make us better clinicians, because we'll know who to treat with which neurochemicals and not just lump them into big categories that just don't fit everybody. Digital assessments, wearables, improving engagement and accuracy of the data that I think we're getting clinically. And finally, etiologic contributors like genetics can be found and can guide treatment. So it is worth asking the questions. On the treatment side, we know from studies, multi-site double-blind studies, that digital therapeutics for attention work. And they last not only, to the end of the study, but sometimes, at least in our study, up to 3 years. That we think that synergistic treatment of both the brain and the body together may work better. Autonomic stimulation through the vagal nerve using the electrical stimulation at the earlobes seems to work. A lot more study both on mechanism as well as some really well-designed placebo-controlled studies are critical at this juncture. And pharmacogenetics can guide your choice of medications and finding the right tool with experts who you can call for help when you get findings back, as well as the dashboard, for me makes a big difference in how useful I find them. And with that, we're almost at the end of the day, and I'm at the end of my presentation. Thank you for bearing with me at the beginning of my technical difficulties. We can all breathe a couple of times, me included, and I'm happy to take any questions. Thank you, guys.
Thank you so much. That is very exciting how we're using our new understanding of neurochemicals and of the neurology to have much more personalized medicine. So instead of just saying you're autistic, you get this medicine or this treatment, we can be a lot more specific about and biological and objective about how we approach things. There's still a lot of research to be done, but this is the cutting edge talk to see what directions we're going. There's a question about what can you say about transcranial magnetic stimulation as a treatment for ASD? Is that the same as the cranial electrotherapy you mentioned in your talk?
That is such a great question. One of my clinical partners at Lifetime Neurodevelopmental Care, Kevin Shapiro, did his PhD work in TMS. And there's some great work at Stanford. UCSF's got some, I think, interesting study going on. It's different. TMS is, with a figure eight shaped magnet where you want to stimulate directly to the cortex. And I think it is a powerful treatment, and I think that there is going to be some good clinical applications. I don't know if we've gotten a little ahead of ourselves in the clinical delivery of TMS, because you certainly can get TMS at different clinical practices around the Bay Area and around the country. And I think that there's been a lot of interest on the research side and not a lot of really sort of solid research data that I know of. There may be some experts out there. I think it is going to be in the armamentarium. I think it's a powerful tool, and I would love to know more about how to use it and for whom. One thing I can say is that it's not just, I think, for folks with autism. I think that probably the research in mental health more broadly is ahead of the autistic community research. I like to think of it more as like sensory based, but that's my hat. And then I think for headaches, that's also an emerging clinical area. So I'm excited about the future of TMS. Very excited.
Thank you so much, and thank you for your practice-based research. I think that's really moving us forward. I appreciate it.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.